Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa for the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tunisia's president appoints the country's first female prime minister.
It's clearly a somewhat effective move because she is a woman. But at the same time, Mr. Saied has suspended the parliament and variated from the path that Tunisia was progressing on July 25th.
South Africa opposition parties hope to defeat the ruling ANC in upcoming local government elections. Tomorrow, Friday, is Southern Cameroon Independence Day, but the separatists have declared a ghost town, and 2.1 million Kenyans face hunger due to drought.
We normally used to get milk and the meat, and sometimes selling the animals to get other sorts of food like the rice or sugar and other things. Now that the animals are very emaciated, nobody can buy them because the drought has affected them to an extent that no milk can come from the animal.
And a center has opened in South Africa about how to survive a carjack. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tunisian President Kais Saied on Wednesday chose Najla Boudin Ramdani as the country's first female prime minister. Recently, President Saied has dismissed his government and froze parliament. Samia Shihata is the associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He says while the appointment of Ramdani is a welcome development because she is a woman, it is also becoming apparent that President Saied is more and more ruling by decree.
It's clearly a somewhat effective move because, as you yourself mentioned, is that she is a woman. That this is a big change and so on, which it is, of course, and that needs to be acknowledged. But at the same time, the context is that Mr. Saied has suspended the parliament and variated from the path that Tunisia was progressing on July 25th. And we have not had anything really other than his executive authority since then. So my point is he's been effective in that he has not only appointed a prime minister, but appointed somebody who has made people forget that there has been no prime minister and power has been solely in his hands since July 25.
I understand it's good to have a woman prime minister, but did he do it constitutionally? Because there was a prime minister before her.
Right. Well, this gets to the question of what occurred on July 25, 2021, and whether it was a coup or whether he properly understood and implemented Article, I believe it's 80 or 88, I've forgotten, of the Tunisian Constitution, in which he can suspend Parliament. And there's a debate about that, right? And part of the debate, it's technical, has to do with the fact that Tunisia still doesn't have a constitutional court, right? Because the article alludes to that. So if we give him the benefit of the doubt in his interpretation that it was constitutional, then he does have the right to appoint a new prime minister. None of that is to justify the concentration of power that his ability now to rule by decree, that he has frozen parliament, that he can unilaterally write legislation, and that it's been now several months since parliament has played a role in government and in which there has been this concentration of power in the president. So I think one has to understand the context, and it is a little bit tricky, but in order to really understand what's going on and the complicated nature of it, one has to understand the context.
10 years ago, many Tunisians, and I would say also many Africans, admired the country's popular democracy uprising. Now, why do you think it has been so difficult for a stable government to emerge in that country?
Well, as you know, and as your listeners know, as soon as one topples an authoritarian regime, the struggle isn't over. In fact, what has emerged and what we knew kind of as academics before is that despite the fact that it is very difficult to topple an authoritarian regime, especially one that had been in power in Tunisia for at least 23 years, the Ben Ali regime, and then the Bourguiba regime even before that, extending to 1956, it's even harder to establish a consolidated, stable democracy. And that's really quite a profound idea that, you know, you can defeat a Mubarak, even though it seems impossible, or a Ben Ali, or maybe even a Mugabe, and so on. But then establishing a democracy with institutions that mean something, that have weight, that are respected, an inclusive political system in which there are different branches of government and power is distributed, and so on, that is even more of a challenge. And so, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that Tunisia has had its ups and downs. And again, you know, one also has to remember that Tunisia is a developing country. It's had economic problems. It's also had COVID spike recently and so on, and a COVID crisis. And revolutions are inherently destabilizing. Tunisia depends on tourism and so on. The uprising and then now COVID has had negative effects on the tourism industry and so on. And so you're trying to undertake a political transition while at the same time still having major, major economic difficulties.
Samir Shihata is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. You're speaking with us from Washington, D.C. In South Africa, the promises are being pledged and the accusations are flying. Yes, it's election season as the country builds towards the local government polls scheduled for the 1st of November this year. Opposition parties have strong hopes of beating the ruling African National Congress or ANC candidates and replacing them with mayors and city and town councillors from their own ranks. Darren Taylor has more.
The ANC manages most municipalities in South Africa, but independent local government monitors say many are dysfunctional, corrupt, and poorly run. In those areas, residents complain of substandard services, such as a water supply that's regularly interrupted. ANC executive member Mamakolo Kubai acknowledges its municipalities have had problems since the party came to power in 1994, but she insists things aren't as bad as they seem.
Provision of electricity across the country is sitting above 90%. I think it's around 95%. And areas where we've not been able to do 5% will be your informal settlements, the areas where, in terms of infrastructure, becomes difficult. That's why alternative energy is being provided.
Opposition parties agree that ANC municipalities have electrified most of the country. But that doesn't mean much when ANC councils don't maintain essential infrastructure, causing frequent blackouts.
There is no better investment in the economy and into jobs than getting the basics right.
Gwen Ngwenya, head of policy for the Chief Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, spoke during the party's recent online launch of its election manifesto.
Businesses are not very different to households. They also care about the same things. They care about infrastructure. They care about reliable electricity, etc. These are the bones of which any business is also built on, in the same way as households.
Going into these polls, it seems as if the DA again represents the biggest threat to ANC dominance in the municipal sphere, following a consistent erosion of ANC support over the past two decades. The DA already controls a number of towns and cities, including two major metros, Cape Town and Tshwane. According to independent organizations, where the DA governs, services are generally much better than in ANC-run municipalities. But Kubai insists the DA is failing citizens, like in Tshwane.
You get wrong electricity billing, you get wrong billing systems. People are complaining about electricity, water cuts, without even a process. You go to complain, you phone on the lines, there's just disruption. We have policies of indigent communities where we look after the child-headed households, where we look after the senior citizens. Under DA leadership, they cancel that.
In fact, the DA scrapped the ANC's anti-poverty programs to replace them with its own. DA leader John Steenhuisen says he's well aware of how challenging it is to manage city councils in a country where tens of millions of people live in poverty.
That's why we're making the case. Give us a majority in those municipalities so we can get things done in that municipality. It's very difficult to do things from an opposition. It's a lot easier to do it when you're in government, you're in the driving seat, you're able to affect the change, you're able to amend the policy, you're able to adjust the budgets. That's how you get things done.
South Africans also have the choice of voting for many other smaller parties, like the Patriotic Alliance, led by former armed robber Gayton McKenzie.
We have promised, and people know we keep our promise, that if we take over at 9 a.m., at 3 o'clock, the very same day, all illegal foreigners, you are going home, you are being arrested. We cannot have illegal foreigners here.
But political analysts say citizens won't care about such issues on November 1st. They'll simply be voting for less crime in their neighbourhoods, fewer electricity and water outages, and, possibly above all else, councillors willing to act on their complaints. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The International Rescue Committee says more than 2 million Kenyans are facing hunger due to poor rainfall. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta declared a national disaster this month because of drought. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
36-year-old Sulaiman Ahmed Osman lost 50% of his livestock to drought in the past 6 months. He says more are dying now due to worsening drought.
When we lost, you know, this number of animals, and there's no any other source of income, there's no other source of where we can source our daily meals, because we normally used to get milk and the meat, and sometimes selling the animals to get other source of food like the rice or sugar and other things. Now that the animals are very emaciated, nobody can buy them. No milk, because the drought has affected them to an extent that no milk can come from the animal.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, IFRC, says Kenya received insufficient rainfall during the October to December 2020 and March to May 2021 rainy seasons, leading to the current drought situation. The IFRC report said that the arid and semi-arid areas received less than 50% of the average rainfall in June. The three counties in northeastern Kenya received less than 25% of average rainfall. Abdullahi Musa has been buying animal feeds and water for 4 months now for his more than 100 cattle in Garissa along the Kenya and Somalia border.
There are two sets of livestock herders, he says. There are those who the drought in Kenya has affected them.
There are those who crossed to Somalia to get pasture, but came back due to lack of water, he says. I'm among the people who are not so affected. I have lost some animals, but most of them are alive. But 90% of animal herders have lost their livestock. They got nothing. The International Rescue Committee says 2.1 million people in Kenya are now food insecure. The head of the organization in Kenya, Mohamed El Mutasari Hussein, says he is concerned about the growing humanitarian situation in some 20 out of 47 counties.
Our concerns overall is the protracted drought situation and the protracted aspect of drought in Kenya that is being over the years coming again and again, and also that concern extended to actually the growing humanitarian needs as people move out of their hometowns, you know, searching for places closer to water sources.
The IRC says climate change is the main driver of the region's recurring drought and locust outbreaks. Kenya's National Drought Management Authority predicts the food insecurity situation will persist until the end of the year. The Drought Management Authority says people's fortunes may change if the affected areas get rain in the next 3 months. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 30th. The head of the World Health Organization has apologized after a new report alleges rape and sexual abuse by workers sent to fight Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. A special investigation identified 83 suspects, including 21 employees by the WHO. In releasing the report, WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called it a dark day for the agency and said the perpetrators will be brought to justice. He said two already have been placed on administrative leave. Contracts are being terminated for four who will be banned from future employment at the WHO and with the broader UN system to be notified about their actions. Tedros admitted he had been to the country 14 times without anyone raising the matter and said he probably should have asked more questions. Tomorrow, Friday, is Southern Cameroon Independence Day. On October 1, 2017, Southern Cameroonians declare their territory the Independent Ambazonian Republic. October 1, 1961 was also the day that Southern Cameroon got its independence from Britain when it chose to become part of the Republic of Cameroon rather than part of Nigeria. Cameroon President Paul Biya does not recognize the independence of Southern Cameroon from Cameroon. Since 2017, separatists known as the Ambazonia Defense Forces have been fighting the Cameroonian military. The separatists have declared Friday a ghost town. Joining us from Douala for Perspectives is Ellie Smith, journalist and former secretary of the Anglophone General Conference.
After the fall of the German Empire and the defeat by the Anglo-French military, German Cameroon was divided into two. In fact, into three. A large chunk was under France, and then the other smaller chunks were subdivided between northern British Cameroons and southern British Cameroons. And on the 11th of February 1961, a plebiscite was organized by the United Nations to determine the future of these territories, the people of British Southern Cameroons and the people of British Northern Cameroons. And they had two questions. Do you want to attain independence by integrating into the Federation of Nigeria or by reuniting with the Independent Republic of Cameroon? The people of British Northern Cameroons, then part of Northern Nigeria, opted to integrate into the Nigerian Federation, and it was known as the Saduna Province, while the people of British Southern Cameroons, currently known as the Northwest and Southwest Region, opted to reunite with the Independent Republic of Cameroon as the Federal Republic of Cameroon.
Under what banner is this day being commemorated? I'm asking this question because of the present separatist movement, or where we now have Ambazonia versus the Republic of Cameroon. Under what banner is this day being commemorated?
The banner under which this day is celebrated is kind of controversial because, well, history is something one can't change. The reality is what I have told you, that the former British Cameroons or British Southern Cameroons opted to reunify with the Republic of Cameroon in 1961 as a federal republic. The problem now is there are some individuals in Anglophone Cameroon or the Northwest and Southwest who are claiming that the reunification, there wasn't any treaty between British Southern Cameroons and the Republic of Cameroon, that treaty would have been signed by both parliament and deposited at the secretariat of the UN. But such an argument is a kind of disinformation campaign led by some aggrieved Anglophones or erstwhile Southern Cameroonians.
How does the Cameroon government see the commemoration of this day versus the people in Southern Cameroon?
I think the perception of the government of Cameroon is that it is an attempt to tinker or to challenge the hard-fought unity of both states. However, I think, because after reunification, that day was celebrated in 1962. It's part of the history of this country, which can't be refused. But the problem now is with the rise of a weaponized secessionist movement, I think the government perceives it as a danger because most of those supporting the Independence Day kind of attack those who are not for.
Ellie Smith is a journalist and former secretary of the Anglophone General Conference. You are speaking with us from Douala, Cameroon. In South Africa, hijacking of motor vehicles by criminals is so common that a center aimed at preventing the crime and instructing people how to survive such an incident has opened. Police say there are about 50 carjackings a day in the country. In the final quarter of the year, following harsh lockdowns because of COVID-19, the crime is once again spiking. Darren Taylor has more.
Law enforcement agencies say South Africa is a prime hunting ground for organized crime groups specializing in vehicle theft. It's the second biggest economy in Africa, with a lot of vehicles of all types on the road. Syndicates pay criminals to steal specific models of cars, from luxury SUVs to simple sedans. Drivers and passengers who resist are often shot dead. The gangs use corrupt officials to help ship the stolen vehicles to markets across the continent. The crimes come into focus recently in South Africa, following a few carjackings during which the criminals drove away with babies on board, but later abandoned them.
When the hijackers select a motor vehicle, it is sometimes irrelevant for them if there's a child on board or not. The motivating factor behind the attack is the value attached to the motor vehicle.
Former police officer Richard Brousseau is the founder of South Africa's Hijack Prevention Academy. He says having a baby on board a stolen car is a carjacker's worst nightmare.
Look at this from a hijacker's point of view. If I do not give you 10 seconds to retrieve the child, I've got the whole of South Africa behind me. If I give you 10 seconds to grab the child, I've basically got one or two cars behind me. So they don't want to take kids with if they can help it.
At his academy, he teaches people a few simple but potentially life-saving lessons.
Most hijackings happen in a home driveway, 68%. When you drive home, that last kilometer, focus on your surroundings. I know the kids talk in the car, but we have to get our kids involved. I'm not saying little ones, but I would say 5, 6 years and older. I'm not saying scare them, but we have to start educating kids.
Brousseau says developing just a few carjack prevention skills could prevent tragedy.
When you arrive at your house, stop parallel to the gate so you can't be boxed in. Small little things. You don't stop the crime by doing things like this. You shift the target onto someone else. It sounds terrible when I put it that way, but that's unfortunately reality in South Africa.
He expects carjackings to increase in the months to come, as they always do in the run-up to the summer holidays. So he advises drivers and their passengers to be extremely vigilant.
If there's a car behind you and that car just overtakes you, don't think it's nothing. Sit there for 10 seconds before you go and stop in front of your gate and ask yourself, that car that has overtaken me, where are they going? They've gone to the end of the road. Wait a couple of seconds. That 3, 4 houses further down where they've stopped, are they climbing out of the car? What are they doing there?
Brousseau agrees that his anti-carjacking training center is more proof of soaring crime in South Africa and citizens' growing paranoia about being the next victim. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great day.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. A conversation about Iran and U.S.-Iran relations with Professor Hussein Banai. VOA Persian Service colleague Siamak Dehampour and I ask Banai about Iran's new hardline president, Ibrahim Raisi, and what drives the Islamic regime's domestic, international, and nuclear policies. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show. designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.